Called me. I crossed my arms over my chest. I thought you were out of the detective game. Oh, now, I never said I was out for good. I remember my hope that he was coming to spin me around to kiss me. I think I dreamed about it last night. I have vague flashes of his pointy little face above mine, that thick, glossy hair brushing against my cheek. Those little hands deft. I place my hands in my pockets, and the shock of hair covering my bruise falls out of position and reveals the greenish skin. Desmond notices it and gasps. What happened? Just a fall. Onto what, someone's fist? He reaches out to touch the gash, but I squirm to the left. Begrudgingly, I tell him about what happened in the parking lot on Friday, and that the picture I'd taken was now missing. He looks aghast. I should have stayed with you, made sure you got safely into the Uber. Nothing happened to me, exactly, I say, except that I had a panic attack and lost consciousness, and then the police came and they drove me home. You know, totally normal day. How intriguing that the assailant deleted the file, Desmond muses. It has to be someone who knows something, right? Someone who doesn't want you to figure out who Leonidas is speaking with. I nod. This is what I've deduced, too. Desmond places his hands on his hips. You know, you can subpoena phone records. We should explain this to the police. I make a face. On what grounds? It's not like I have much proof besides eavesdropping on Leonidas' conversation. Desmond looks chagrined. We should try and get proof. I nod, though I have no idea how we could get this. I'm pretty sure a number I know was on that call list. I've tried all weekend to remember, but I can't. I sigh. Even better, I wish I could just remember who I was talking to that night in Palm Springs, and maybe even who pushed me into the pool. Desmond paces the room, then suddenly snaps his fingers. I have an idea. I suck in my stomach. There's something propositional about his voice. What? I've been reading up on how to unlock memories. Sometimes, the key is to go back to the scene of where you lost them. They can return just by smelling the same smells or hearing the same sounds. We should go back to the tranquility. What, today? I have the day off. His gaze goes to my bruise again. Unless you're feeling too infirm. I run my tongue over my teeth, and all at once they feel smooth and clean. It's not like I have anything else to do today besides panic. The tranquility looms in my mind like a book I don't want to open, because I'm not sure I want to know how it ends. But maybe Desmond is right. Maybe everything will slot into place if we go. Okay, I say. At the very least, it would be an opportunity to retrieve my car from the resort's garage. I'd thought my family was going to chariot it back for me, but as far as I know, it's still there. Once again in the Batmobile, Desmond plays a favorite song from a CD compilation in his disc player, something heavy with mandolins. I play one next, Slater Kinney. I watch his expression, suddenly curious of what he thinks. Interesting. He says, and finds another song on a CD. A lute, some mewling. I keep my expression neutral, but I notice him watching me in the same way I was watching him. I burst out laughing. NPR, sports radio, Spanish for a few minutes, even though neither of us really knows the language. We follow an old VW Beetle, a pink stretch limo with happy chicks painted on the side. A bright blue bus of old people. Desmond waves to the old people, and many of them wave back. Toward the back of the bus, a younger, shadowed face appears, and I flinch. I'm looking at an image of myself. Are you all right? Desmond asks, because I must have made some sort of noise. The bus lags a little behind us. The angle of the sunlight changes, and the face in the window is gone. There is sweat spilling down my neck into my underwear. I chew viciously on a fingernail. I just thought I saw something. Someone. Who? I press my hand hard against my knee. Me, I want to say. But I know that's impossible. Out loud. I don't know. But it was someone who looked like they knew me, maybe. By the time we pull up to the Tranquility sweeping front drive, I am feeling sweaty and starving, and maybe like this isn't a very good idea. I still don't really know Desmond. Who's to say he isn't dangerous? Should I have alerted Bill and my mother? They'd seemed so offended that I disappeared to Palm Springs the last time without telling them. We stop the car, and a valet immediately appears to relieve us.
"Good afternoon," Desmond says dramatically, using a fake Dracula accent.
He tosses the valet his keys, and I notice he has a wimpy throw. I bet he was picked last for teams in junior high gym.
"Sweet ride," the valet says, handing us a ticket. "You two staying with us?"
Desmond glances at me with one eyebrow raised.
"Shall we? Perhaps a sweet pardieu."
My smile wobbles, but I'm still feeling sort of out of it. So I snap, "Of course not, and I think your French is wrong." He walks inside, and I reluctantly follow. Desmond tries to take my arm, and I let him for a few seconds before dropping it. Halfway across the floor, the smell of tequila wafts into my nose, and I swoon. All at once, pieces of memories that I don't know what to do with rush my brain. I see myself, younger, sitting on a bar stool, laughing at someone. Me and a person, lounging on a couch together. Leonidas? Desmond touches my arm.
"Is it happening?"
he asks, excitedly.
"Are you remembering?"
"I don't know," I murmur, taking a deep breath to try to steady my legs. We walk past an indoor desert garden of waterfalls, cacti, and terracotta sculptures. The atrium is fragrant with floral succulents, a potpourri of people in southwestern garb, probably purchased in the gift shop, lounge on big chairs in front of a floor-to-ceiling window that overlooks a desert vista.
"This is truly an oasis," Desmond says, tenting his fingers. "I used to come here as a child with my father. It's why I bring my team down here. I always feel so centered in this place. You too?"
I blink hard, the memory swirling around my head suddenly gone. "Maybe."
"Did you come here as a child as well?"
"I think so."
"You think?"
It feels like something I was sure of only days ago, maybe even minutes ago. How I know of this place, my history within it, and why I'd chosen to come here on the day of my almost drowning. It's not like it's a Ritz-Carlton. It's not like it's featured regularly in Travel and Leisure. It's one of those places you have to know about to find. We must have come here when I was younger. My mom, Gabby, Bill, and me. I distinctly remember hiking up that trail out back, yelling my name between the two canyons to hear the echo. It's just that what happened in between is missing. But this isn't what I need to focus on right now. I need to think about my most recent visit. If I can just retrace my steps, I can remember who hurt me. I picture myself in the lobby, walking over to the front desk to check in. I recall the smooth key in my hand. I remember a woman in a crisp white shirt sliding my American Express card back across the counter with a tight smile. I remember taking a mint from a dish and popping it into my mouth.
"Would you like to book any spa services, miss?"
the woman had asked me. But I'd shaken my head. No massages for me. No facials or manicures. So what had I come here to do? Drink. And drink heavily. But why? Was it because I knew, subconsciously, the tumor was back? I wish it were that simple. Could something have set me off then? What had happened that day before I went? I try to think. I probably woke up like I always did and choked down vitamins and a smoothie. I probably talked to Kiki. I had received the boxes containing copies of my book that day. Could that be something? "Come on," I say, tugging Desmond's arm. "Let's go to the bar I was at before the pool." We look at the map on the wall. The shipstead is through a hallway, past a couple of gift shops and the spa, down an elevator,
and past the fanciest restaurant. Outside, the pool beckons, the cheerful orange cabana cloths flapping in the light wind. A few people are lying on the chaises, reading books. The blue water glistens. I'm surprised it's open, actually. It sounds ridiculous, but I was hoping they would have closed it off after I'd been fished out. A man glides in the water with a baby buoyed by a large round float. The baby's smile is all gums. She splashes her father giddily. Neither of them have any idea I'd been lying at the bottom 9 days ago. I wonder what the father would do if I told him. It's 3 p.m., a dead time, especially on a Monday, and the Shipstead's bartender, who's wearing a sailor suit, grimaces as he wipes the counter by the bottles. The wallpaper features diagrams of how to tie different sailing knots. The room smells like Old Spice. Desmond surveys the room, then looks at me. Do you remember where you were sitting? I pick a stool at the bar, though I have absolutely no recollection. The bartender places coasters imprinted with jaunty navy blue anchors in front of us and asks if we'd like a menu. Desmond asks what sort of absinthe they've got. The bartender names a brand, to which Desmond makes a face. Amateurs, he whispers, but he orders it anyway. I consider ordering nothing. I already feel naturally tipsy. But then I blurt out, a stinger. It feels like the right answer. I'd had one that night. The bartender nods. When he reaches for the martini glass, he has to stand on his tiptoes. A heady scent of deodorant wafts from his underarms. You aren't Richie by any chance, are you? I call to him. He turns around and blinks at me. No, Sam. Is Richie here? Nope. He adds various liquids to a stainless shaker. Not today. At least Richie actually exists. Do you know when he's around next? The bartender frowns. He's handsome, but he's short. And the bell-bottomed one-piece just makes him look even smaller. Almost like a child. He has tattoos of numbers in a random pattern on every finger. A phone number? Birth and death dates? Are you a friend of his? No, I was at this bar 2 Saturdays ago, and Richie was my bartender. I'm trying to figure out who I was sitting next to, I say in the most pleasant, sane voice I can muster. I spoke to the person for a while that night, but I didn't catch her name. I was hoping Richie could help me. There's half a smile on the bartender's face. As he sets down our drinks, he looks sympathetic. That's happened to me a few times, too. I hit it off with someone, it seems like something, and he leaves before I get his phone number. You could place an ad on Craigslist, you know. Miss Connections. Ever read those? Cashier at the 76 on Main Street. I'm the tall, thin guy who comes in the mornings for hot chocolate and Red Bull. You waved at me. Maybe you'll see this. You could do something like that. My mouth, I'm sure, is hanging open. Oh, I'm not trying to get a date out of this. The bartender blinks at me. Oh, he says woodenly. He abruptly walks away to serve an older couple who has just come in. Desmond pours the green liquid over his absinthe. I used to post on Missed Connections. I never got a response. I don't know anyone who ever got a response. Kind of makes you wonder why it still exists. I point at him playfully. I thought social media made you sad. Snapchat makes me sad. Selfies make me sad. Thinking that a text message serves as a love letter makes me sad. Posting on Missed Connections? That was poetry. You're so weird. I down my cocktail and gag. The stinger tastes bitter, unlike things I usually drink, but the flavor doesn't conjure any new memories. Desmond drinks slowly, tapping his toe at the smooth, sax-heavy jazz number on the stereo. The old couple sips wine and talks quietly. The bartender ignores us, making a big deal out of cleaning the barware. In the distance, a maid feverishly vacuums the rug, her head bopping to music over her headphones. So, tell me how you think it transpired, Desmond says in a low voice.
You came into this bar. Is that right?
I look around. I think so. And I spoke to someone. I'm sure of it. Someone who said, you've got to get a hold of yourself. I squeeze my eyes shut tightly. If only I knew who.
Do you think it's someone you knew?
I feel like it, yes. But I was also surprised to see the person here. It felt very unexpected.
So maybe it was Leonidas. I mean, if you're already broken up, you wouldn't expect to see him, right?
Yeah, I guess.
Let's assume it is him. He sits next to you at the bar. You have a conversation. He says, you've got to get a hold of yourself.
Does that seem right? It could be.
And then what? What do you think you talked about?
I don't know.
Your breakup? Maybe you were really upset. Maybe that's why he said you had to get a grip.
Maybe.
But what got you out to the pool? Desmond muses. Leonidas must have said something to get you to head out there. You needed some air? Or maybe he wanted to be intimate.
He gets a goofy look on his face when he says it, and I blush. I doubt it. I was feeling afraid, not sexy.
Okay, so maybe Leonidas says something that frightens you, like he's going to hurt you. You run out to the pool, you have a bigger argument, maybe about your breakup. He pushes you in.
He smiles triumphantly. Maybe, I say, emptily.
Maybe not.
I swivel and look at the pool out the window. Now, a couple of kids are splashing each other in the shallow end. A woman in a black bikini dips in her long legs near the diving board. I feel like the person who pushed me was a woman.
Oh. Desmond frowns, studies his cocktail napkin, which is an illustration of various knots, like the wallpaper. But maybe my memory is wrong. I mean, Leonidas knows me. He was talking about me on the phone. It fits.
Or maybe it doesn't, Desmond says. I mean, I met him, Eliza. He seemed...
well, he seemed like a big dumb dog, no offense. So maybe it was someone else.
Deep down, I agree with him. It would be easy if Leonidas was the answer. But it doesn't feel right. We don't say anything for a while. Someone is using a leaf blower outside.
To blow what, I wonder. We're in the desert.
Did you ever hear the story about the starlet who was murdered here in the 60s? I ask Desmond to break the silence. He shakes his head. So I explain about the mix-up. When I'm done, Desmond looks chagrined.
Poor Diana Dane, he cries.
What are you talking about? She's the one that lived. It's Gigi Reese you're supposed to pity. Someone killed her, and they didn't even care who. Her mystery was never solved.
I know, that's sad too. But it's an unexpected sort of sad.
But imagine what Diana Dane had to deal with. All those articles talking about her death.
Do you think all of them were nice? Maybe someone snuck something disparaging in there, since she wouldn't be around to defend herself.
I'm pretty sure they all sung her praises.
Oh.
Desmond blots his face with a napkin.
Still, the idea of someone mistaking someone else for you is spooky. I wonder if she had any moments of thinking, hey, if everyone thinks I'm dead, perhaps I am. Public opinion can sway all sorts of truths.
You're missing the point of the story.
Or maybe she thought, hey, this gives me an out. I can leave Hollywood, start another life, go on a crime spree. No one will catch me because they all think I'm dead.
But she loved Hollywood. She didn't go on a crime spree. Desmond sips his drink.
Huh. There's so much more possibility to her story if she decided to run with the whole dead thing.
I squeeze my eyes shut, feeling more and more annoyed.
The point is that poor dead Gigi Reese went unnoticed.
The point is that some people are remembered only because they resemble someone else. If I had a double, I might go on a crime spree, Desmond says dreamily. No, you wouldn't. Okay, I probably wouldn't. But I do something unexpected. For me, I mean. I try to imagine what would be out of character for Desmond. Joining a fantasy football league, maybe. Adopting a child. I wonder about the anti-Eliza. I would take up residence at an ashram. I would breathe deeply and worry little. Another stinger arrives, even though I haven't signaled for it. I suck it down, wincing once again at the flavor. Who on earth would drink a cocktail with creme de menthe? The opening bars of a song peel through the room, and my head shoots up. Lowrider. It's the same song I heard when I was here. I go very still, concentrating on each note, trying to picture the last time I'd heard the song. I might have been sitting on this very stool, looking out at the same view. And when I turned my head, fear ripples through me. I see a shadow. I shoot to my feet. What? Desmond says, sliding off his stool too. Someone wants to hurt me. Desmond's eyes widen. Who? But I don't know. I've only been given this thought and only this thought exactly. And yet the fear is liquefied, coursing through my veins. Something in this bar frightened me that night. I'd hurtled off the stool just like I have today. And I looked for the first exit I could find. And that's what I do now, too. Except my body is pointed in the other direction today. So the exit I lunge for is the one into the hallway back to the hotel. I stagger there, arms outstretched like a zombie, the music piping through the speakers abnormally loud. Eliza! Desmond cries, stumbling behind me. What are you... I hear the bartender protest something about being paid for the drinks, but I don't turn, and Desmond doesn't either. All I know is that I have to get off this floor. Away. Whatever I feared weeks ago is still here, now. I punch the elevator button, and mercifully, the doors open immediately. I get in and press the button for the lobby. Desmond leaps inside as the doors are closing. What's going on? He asks me, panting. Eliza, what's happening? Tell me what you're thinking. Who are you afraid of? What did you see? My brain twists and bucks. I'm scrambling for more, and I'm not getting any answers. I press my thumbs to my eye sockets until I see stars. When I peek at Desmond again, there is a nervous, uncertain look on his face. Someone you've met before? He tries. Who does this person look like? Like me, I want to say. But I don't know where this has come from. I certainly didn't come up with it. But then I remember that face on the bus. That face in the window at my mother's house. My face, my face, my face. Why do I keep seeing myself? I look at Desmond blankly. Lost. My jaw feels unhinged from my skull. The elevator dings. The door slides open on the lobby level. I shrink back at the throng of people waiting to get in. But Desmond leads me by the hand and sits me down on a leather chair near a large saguaro cactus that is somehow growing indoors. Eliza, he says, his voice cracking. You're burning up. I'm okay. Sweat prickles down my spine. No, you're not. Talk to me, please. Who did you see? Why did you run away?
I don't know.
And then suddenly, the shakes come on. My whole body rolls with them. They travel all the way down to my fingertips, sharp little zingers. I chatter my teeth. I feel my eyeballs curl inward. I'm seizing. I can feel it. I shut my eyes and feel my head hit the leather ottoman. I can hear Desmond shouting above me, but I can't do anything to get to him or talk to him. Just don't call other people over, I wish I could tell him. Just let me ride this out. Something tells me I've had a seizure in public before. Something tells me I got too much attention for it. And then, suddenly, it's over. My eyes focus again. Sound rushes back, and I have the use of my voice. I sit up, noting that I've left a pool of sweat from my hair on the ottoman. When I look at Desmond, though, he is staring at me in horror. Several other people stand over me, including a few men in hotel garb. "Is she okay?" one of them is saying. Beyond them, a few guests crane their necks. I hear the words ambulance and fainted and drunk. Someone clears his throat behind us. It's the bartender from the Shipstead. He's brought the bill. Desmond stands, leads him a few steps away to take care of the transaction. I sit on the ottoman, staring at the crosshatchings in my palm, feeling cold, slimy embarrassment. Desmond says nothing as he sits back down. "Sorry about that," I mutter, finally, because I feel like I must say something. He pauses before speaking. "I want to call an ambulance." I feel a bolt of shock. "Are you kidding?" "Maybe you need a professional. Someone who can help you." I curl my hands into fists. "I can't believe you." "Eliza, you were terrified. You need to unlock what was scaring you. So you want to commit me? Just like everyone else?" He looks horrified. "Of course not. I just want to know what's wrong." But maybe that's not what he means. It could be just a tactic to soften me up. I turn my back. "You don't know me at all, Desmond, so don't pretend that you do." He scuttles around to face me again. "I didn't mean for you to think. You know how I mentioned a brain tumor?" I interrupt. "Well, I think it's still hanging around, messing with my head, causing me to say things and remember things I have no control of, causing my body to move in strange ways. It's not some psycho tick, okay? I'm not crazy." His mouth drops open. "Oh, Eliza. Oh, dear. I'm sorry." "Yeah, well, sorry doesn't really cut it. Not now." This is unfair. I'm saying all this because I'm embarrassed and vulnerable. But I need him to leave me alone, pretend it never happened. Coming here was a terrible idea. "What can I do?" he pleads. "How can I help? Maybe you do need an ambulance then. I can handle it." I cross my arms over my chest, feeling a wall come up around me. He tries to get me to look at him, but I don't. "I'm smitten by you, Eliza," Desmond says. "You're like the Lady of the Lake. I don't understand a lot about you, but I'd spend the rest of my life figuring you out. I want to help you however I can, including figuring out what scared you so much. I want to save you." "I don't need saving." "Of course you don't. You're strong. You're impenetrable. But you want to know who hurt you, don't you? I think your brain and your body just gave you a huge clue. Like I said, I've been reading up on memory, and I think just being here is working." I glare at him. "How do I know you didn't hurt me, Desmond?" He draws back. The color drains from his face. What? "You just happened to be walking by and fish me out of the pool on the night of a storm? You just happened to have seen someone running away? You could be saying that to take the heat off yourself." His hands are at his mouth. "Why would I do such a thing?" "Because you're strange. Maybe I was bitchy to you in the bar. Maybe I made fun of you when we were younger and I don't remember you. You were absolutely the kind of person I would have made fun of." Desmond shakes his head, his eyes unblinking. "You have to believe me. I didn't push you. I would never." I pointedly turn away. I really don't think Desmond pushed me. It's probably good I threw it out there, but I know it isn't true. I just wanted to hurt him. It's too hard for me to have someone care this much. I have a coiled up feeling that things with Desmond will end badly, disappointingly, devastatingly. And maybe it's just better to push him away before he pushes me. Maybe I've been in this situation before. With Leonidas, perhaps. But more likely with my mother. Desmond's shoulders heave, and then he stands. Let's have dinner and forget all about this. No way, I say stiffly. I'm getting my car out of the garage, and I'm leaving. Don't be crazy. You just had an episode. You're in no state to drive. I'll be fine. Absolutely not. I'll drive you. Desmond reaches out and grabs my arm, but I wheel around and give him the most searing glare I can muster. I said no. I march across the lobby. I feel tipsy from the stinger, and not in a good way. Memories and feelings are bumping into one another in my head. Me pushing Desmond away, me feeling afraid, that seizure. A half-formed picture is taking shape in my mind, except it's still under a drop cloth. I wonder if I'll ever get to see what it is. In the driveway, the same valets wait at their post. The one who took Desmond's car notices me and snaps to his feet.
Need the Batmobile, miss? He chuckles. Man, I've always wanted to say that.
I shake my head angrily. I'm even furious at Desmond's car. No thanks. And for the record, it's basically a glorified Buick.
Did you have a nice stay at the Tranquility?
He asks, not missing a beat. I consider this question. Across the drive, people are going on a hike in the blazing sun. Cacti jut out on the plateau. They look picturesque and innocuous from 200 yards away. Not like they really are. Spiny, unyielding, mostly dead. Not really, I grumble over my shoulder, halfway to the parking garage. I'm not sure I've ever had fun at this place. Not once in my life. From the Dots. The next Wednesday, Dot walked slowly to the Vaughn's parking lot, not able to get any of the things Marlin had said out of her head. How could he think Dorothy would roofie Dot? Didn't he remember all she'd told him about Dorothy's constant presence in the hospital when she was a little girl? She'd been the only one in Dot's family to come. She cared about Dot so, so much. But Dot also knew Marlin wouldn't lie to her, even if he was jealous about her and Dorothy's relationship. He wasn't Dot's mother. He loved her, honestly and truly, and only wanted the best for her. Worrying about it kept her awake all night. She felt like she had to choose between them. Dorothy was waiting in the car as usual, and she greeted Dot with an enthusiastic wave.
Ready for dinner, my dear.
Dot tried to smile, but her mouth muscles wouldn't work, and she saw herself making a freakish face in the rearview mirror. The whole drive, she couldn't think of a thing to say, so she fiddled with the radio for noise. She settled on a sports announcer just because he was yelling the loudest. Roofies. It throbbed in her mind like an infection. Why would Dorothy have done such a thing? Why had Marlin even put that thought into her mind? Only, she'd read a little about the drug and how it made you feel. The symptoms were certainly familiar. Would the drug still be in her body? Should she get tested for it?
What's with you today? Her aunt asked, poking her arm. You're so quiet.
I'm just thinking about school, Dot said. We have finals soon.
But aren't you an English major? What on earth could be difficult about finals?
At M&F, the waiter had their favorite table all made up and ready. But when it came time to order drinks, Dot said she wanted water. Dorothy's head turned sharply.
No cocktail?
I'm not in the mood. Dorothy scoffed.
When did you become so unfun?
A glass of sparkling water appeared for Dot. She took a sip and swished the bubbles in her mouth as if to wash it clean. Across the table, Dorothy drank from her wine glass and gave her a cool stare. She asked Dot about the books she was reading, and Dot gave one-word answers. She tried to make up stories about the other patrons at the restaurant, but Dot didn't twist around to see who she was talking about. She was reminded suddenly of seeing Dr. Coder in the wheelchair the first time they'd come here. After she'd gone home, she looked Dr. Coder up and learned that not long after Dot left her care, the doctor had been in a tragic fall down the stairwell of the swanky apartment building where she lived. She'd broken her neck. This was on a Facebook page set up by her husband, a man named Evan Coder, not on any sort of news site. One person commented that Dr. Coder should press charges, insinuating that the fall wasn't an accident. But no one followed up on that line of thinking. Doc couldn't find any evidence of a lawsuit. "Did you do something to Dr. Coder?" she blurted. Dorothy's head whipped up. "Who?" "You know who. She's in a wheelchair because of a fall down the stairs. I know you were upset at how she treated us. It happened right after we left." Dorothy's mouth hung open. It was a few moments before she could speak. "How dare you accuse me of such a thing?" "I just..." Dot felt tears come to her eyes. This was so much harder than she'd imagined. "The timing matches up. Her accident was on July 11th. I'd just gone into the new hospital, but I still wasn't doing well. I could understand if you were upset."
"July 11th.
Dorothy narrowed her eyes, thinking. "I know where I was that day. July 11th was my husband Milton's birthday, and I treat myself to a spa day every year in his memory." Milton was the film producer who'd passed away. "I went to the Hyacinth on Beverly Boulevard for the works. After that, I came to the hospital to visit you."
"Oh," Dot said. "I'm sorry."
Dorothy crossed her arms over her chest. Her chin wobbled.
"You know, I'm going to pretend you never said any of that. I'm just going to pretend this didn't happen."
"I'm sorry," Dot whispered again, feeling like a child.
"I shouldn't have doubted you."
Dorothy pressed her lips together, as though to keep from crying.
"You know, your dark moods remind me of the ones Thomas used to have."
Dot sucked in a breath.
"Really?"
"Indeed. My, he would work himself into a lather. I felt like he was doing it on purpose."
She folded her hands at her plate.
"I was all he had in the world, though. Meaning I was the only person he had to push away. I tried to take it as a compliment, of course. But it hurt. I did so much for him. I was the only one who listened."
Dot marveled at how thinly veiled her aunt's words were. But maybe Dorothy had a point. Dorothy was the only person in her life, really. Both of them reached for the last pretzel stick in the basket at the same time. Normally, faced with such a situation, Dot would withdraw her hand and let her aunt take the last piece of bread. But that day, she grabbed the stick and shoved it in her mouth. Food arrived, big steaming plates of steak.
"Ah,"
Dorothy said cheerfully, cutting into hers. She eyed Dot several times. Then she reached for her napkin, knocking her fork to the floor.
"Can you get that, dear?" she asked. "My back isn't what it used to be."
Dot leaned down, but because it was on Dorothy's side, she had to actually kneel on the carpet and lunge to get the utensil. When she returned to the table, Dorothy was sitting heavily back in her seat, as if she'd just been standing. Perhaps she'd just signaled the waiter, because he glided over quickly, and she handed him the fallen fork.
"So,"
she said, folding her arms and looking at Dot with an easy smile.
"Now, tell me what's bothering you, dear."
Dot smeared ketchup around her plate.
"Nothing."
"Is it your boyfriend?"
She shook her head miserably.
"Your mother?"
Dot made a noncommittal noise.
"You can tell me, darling. You can tell me anything."
Dot squeezed her eyes shut, startled at the tears that suddenly formed there. She wished that were true.
"Did I ever tell you about the lover I had in Italy who was part of the Sicilian mob?"
His name was Federico.
Dorothy swooned.
My God, what a man.
If he really exists, Dot muttered, unable to stop herself.
Dorothy frowned.
Pardon?
Dot stared at her shiny utensils.
Nothing.
Dorothy set down her wine glass.
Do my stories bore you?
Dot swallowed hard.
Am I just some windbag?
Dot touched the tines of the fork, wobbled the spoon.
Because I thought I was important to you.
You're awfully important to me. I thought you'd want to hear this stuff.
But if you don't, we can end this evening right now.
Dot hated Marlin suddenly. He'd shoved a spike between her and Dorothy. Who cared if she twisted some details of her time overseas? Who cared if she told a pack of lies? It didn't mean she was evil. It didn't mean she was hurting anyone. She gave so much love. She was the most selfless person Dot had ever met. Marlin was being narrow-minded, perhaps as ageist as those grungy kids in the bar.
I came back just for you, her aunt said. But if it's not worth it for you, I had a good thing going in Italy. I can go right back.
Dot's throat was suddenly dry, and she reached for her glass and took a drink.
Please don't.
Dorothy nodded slowly.
Okay, then.
Good.
She pointed to her water glass.
Drink. You sound hoarse.
After that, the lights brightened, and Dot felt herself unknot. Dorothy told stories, some of her best ever, and Dot began to laugh. Her limbs turned loose, and she enjoyed the dinner. Until the nausea hit her. One minute she was at the table, then, in a blink, she was on the bathroom floor, half in a stall, half by the sink.
Oh, dear, Dorothy said above her.
Dot lay in the back of her aunt's car. Dorothy's voice floated from the driver's seat. The lights of St. Mother Maria's receded in the distance.
Just tell me if I'm driving too fast, her aunt said.
Next thing she knew, it was morning again, and she was waking up in the Magnolia. Panic clutched Dot's chest. This didn't make sense. Here was the same headache. Here was the same non-plussing blankness.
Just rest, Dorothy was telling her, the old refrain.
Dot bolted up. But I only had water last night. Nothing else.
It must have been food poisoning. Or maybe you've got the flu. I wouldn't be surprised living in that dirty dormitory.
Dot didn't feel like she had the flu. She felt hungover. She was about to say this, but then there was a knock at the door.
I bet that's our room service,
Dorothy trilled, the ends of her poppy-printed silk kimono trailing behind her.
You'll feel better once you've had some eggs.
She whipped the door open and made a strange choking sound. Dot sat up fast, head throbbing, and watched as her aunt tried to push the door shut again. Whoever stood on the other side out-muscled her, and the door flew open, banging hard against the stopper on the wall. Dot's mother was backlit against the bright California sunshine. When she stood on tiptoes and saw Dot, her expression darkened and twisted.
I am going to kill you, she whispered, and headed straight for Dot in the bed.
Eliza. The drive home is a repeat of my flight from the Palm Springs Hospital, except I'm in better clothes and in my messy Toyota RAV4 instead of Bill's Porsche. I can still smell Desmond's body spray on me, as though we've rolled together wildly, our skin touching in all kinds of places. I peel one of his long, silky black hairs from my pants and whip it out the open window. After a while, the scenery along I-10 becomes familiar. To avoid post-work traffic, I get off the freeway and turn onto a busy thoroughfare in Alhambra, passing by derelict strip malls and little shacks that sell porn on VHS. After a while, the neighborhood improves and a hospital looms ahead. I see a familiar sight and lose my breath.
Stunned, I cut across four lanes of traffic into a driveway. A neon sign looms above me. M&F Chop House. I park in a space, suddenly shaking. The steakhouse rises above me, brick and stucco and concrete, and real. My vision starts to swirl. When I turn clockwise, there's St. Mother Maria's Hospital across the street. I must have seen this out the window or in an ad and used it for the book. It looks just as I described it in the dots. I push the door open and look around cautiously, as if I'm expecting sirens to go off at my presence. A chunky man with red blotches on his cheeks smiles at me vacantly, then ushers me through the dining room.
"This table is all right?"
he asks. It's in the middle of the space. A menu sits jauntily next to an unlit candle and a small potted succulent. I nod and collapse into the chair. It seems like a normal steakhouse. Wood-paneled bar, framed photographs of old newspaper articles, brass plaques bearing regulars' names on the walls. The only problem is that I know every inch of the room astonishingly well. The place even smells like how I imagined it in the dots. Meaty, saucy, like red wine and money and sex. Perhaps because all steakhouses are alike? Sizzling plates swirl by. A baseball player cracks a hit on television, and the yuppie 20-something bankers with their whiskeys cheer. I rack my memory. Perhaps I was here with Leonidas? Perhaps with Bill and my mother? And I must have driven out this way while researching the book. How else would I know there was a hospital named St. Mother Maria's across the street? How would I know how many floors it had, or that there was a big parking structure right next to it that was taller than the hospital itself? This isn't a neighborhood one takes pictures of or sees on the news. This isn't a neighborhood featured in movies, iconic and quintessential. It's a nothing sort of neighborhood. And yet I seem to know it by heart. My phone buzzes and I look down. It's Desmond. "I'm so sorry. I just wanted to make sure you're okay." And then another text. "I would never, ever harm you. Please understand that. You are the light of my life." And then another. "If you don't want me to contact you again, just say the word. But I shall mourn you until the end of my days." "Get over yourself," I finally respond. Then I turn my phone off. It's probably cruel, and maybe I should forgive him, but it's just too comforting to convert my shame into punishing wrath. As I look around more, I'm surprised to see an unoccupied booth way in the back, almost hidden from view. Something about it seems untended, maybe even condemned. I crane my neck. Could there be a secret door back there, too? I feel so loopy. How is it that this place is so vivid? How do I know all its nooks and crannies? Maybe I'm a better writer than I think. If my mother came in here, if she saw how well I'd captured this, maybe then she'd be impressed. Instead of saying, "This is what you wrote," instead of saying, "Other people read it," instead of saying, "Do something, Bill," instead of saying, "Get up, please." That last thought knocks over a set of dominoes. A latch gives way, opening a door. Get up. Get up. It's a pealing bell in my brain, concentric rings rippling in a pond, a voice telling me to count backward from 10. Maybe it's the overwhelming smell of bloody meat. Maybe it's my aching, throbbing head. Maybe it's the eerie, dizzy awareness of fiction clashing with reality. But all at once, I am standing on the pavement outside Leonidas' father's doctor's office again, and I am smiling about Desmond. And then I am on the pavement, and for a split second, before I fainted, I looked up and saw what I needed to see. The image has only slid into place now. Get up. Please. A face stands over me. The eyes are wide with confusion. The mouth is twitchy and concerned. A hand leans down to check my pulse, and then there's a sigh of relief. The face moves away, and two hands rifle for my phone, and then tap the screen. A backing away. And then the person runs off, legs moving awkwardly. It's the run of a non-athlete. The run of a middle-aged woman. My mother.
From the dots.
Darling, Dorothy said, hurrying after Dot's mother as she crossed the carpet into the hotel suite.
What a wonderful surprise.
Dot's mother dodged Dorothy's open arms and instead grabbed Dot, who was now on her knees, by the wrist.
Get up. Now.
Would you like some coffee? Dorothy said, hurrying behind her.
And room service is coming soon. The Eggs Benedict is divine.
Dot's mother gawked at Dorothy. Don't say another word. She slung an arm around Dot's shoulders. I'm calling the police.
Darling, there's no need to- Mom, what are you doing?
Dot shrieked.
I'm calling them, Dot's mother insisted. I should have called them years ago.
Then she pulled Dot out of the bungalow. The sun was bright in Dot's eyes, intensifying her headache. She twisted around, expecting Dorothy to be chasing after them. But her aunt stood wilted in the doorway. It looked like she might cry.
Dot tried to wriggle from her mom's grasp.
What is wrong with you? Why did you just do that? But her mother was stronger than Dot anticipated, and she wouldn't let go of her wrist. With her other hand, she was talking to someone on the phone.
Yes, I'd like to report that I know the whereabouts of a felon, she said briskly. The Magnolia Hotel in Beverly Hills. Her name is Dorothy Banks.
What the hell are you doing? Dot asked. A felon? Have you gone insane?
Her mother hung up and stared at Dot. She looked angry, shocked, and something else, too. Maybe haunted. Maybe sad.
I can't believe you. I can't believe you would see her, go out with her, without telling me.
Why would I tell you? You hate her, obviously.
Don't you think there's a good reason for that?
Her mother pulled her across the parking lot and unlocked the SUV. Dot sniffed.
Yeah, because you're jealous. And yet, there wasn't as much bite in her defense as there might have been even a few days prior. Her head felt swollen. The dread lay gelatinous in her stomach. She wanted to love Dorothy, and she wanted to trust her. But there was that disconcerting scene back there in the hotel. She shouldn't be sick today.
Dot's mother opened the car door for Dot and indicated for her to get inside. Once Dot did, she quickly shut the door and hurried around to her side.
I wanted to see her, and she wanted to see me, Dot growled when her mother got into the driver's seat. I've missed her. She was gone for 12 years. You can't keep us from each other.
Watch me.
I'm an adult. I can do whatever I want.
Realizing she could just leave, Dot reached for the passenger handle, but her mother caught her arm and pulled it away. She started the engine and backed out of the spot so quickly she almost slammed into the car parked in the space behind them. Dot yelped in surprise. Her mother white-knuckled the wheel and eased gently on the gas.
How many times have you seen her? She demanded.
Dot didn't answer.
How long has this been going on?
Months?
Years?
Just a few months, Dot mumbled into her chest. February, I think. Right around Valentine's Day. Her mother jerkily maneuvered the car through the parking lot.
And what do you do? Where does she take you?
Just to dinner. Dot glowered at her nails, then started picking at one until it started to bleed. The blood looked satisfying running down her hand.
Just to this steakhouse. It's not like we're doing anything wrong. Why would you say she's a felon?
You're delusional.
What do you think she did, rob a bank?
Her mother pressed her lips tightly together.
You know who told me about this situation?
Your boyfriend. He says most Wednesday evenings he can't find you, and Thursdays you're not in your dorm room in the morning. You don't go to class. He says you've been acting strangely and that you're not finishing your assignments anymore. He told me what you've been up to, that you've been seeing her, that you've been drinking,
You're not supposed to drink, Dot, especially not with her.
Dot hated Marlin. How could he have betrayed her to her mother of all people? She tossed her hair as best she could, despite her throbbing head.
She's my family, and she took care of me in case you don't remember.
Her mother let out an ugly laugh.
You really think that's what she was doing? Taking care of you? You really don't know?
Know what?
Her mother looked astonished. Dot, she's trying to kill you.
Dot stared at her incredulously.
But then something on the road distracted her. Look, she cried, pointing.
Her mother had veered into the other lane, and a truck was heading right for them. The driver laid on his horn.
Mother and daughter screamed, but Dot's mother managed to steer out of his way just in time.
Pull over! Dot screamed.
And surprisingly, her mother did. They both breathed heavily, listening to the idling engine. Cars swept past them. Across the street, outside a 7-Eleven, a couple ran toward each other and embraced.
I want out, Dot said, grappling at the door handle.
Her mother hit the lock button.
Don't go.
Please. You don't understand how sick she is.
She's not sick.
Dot really didn't want it to be true.
You're just jealous of her. You've always been. That's why you sent her away from the hospital. You made her leave.
Dot, she was trying to poison you. Dot gawked at her mother.
What?
Her mother pushed her hair out of her face. Her features had elongated into worried ovals. There were frown lines deeply etched into her forehead.
She was poisoning you in the hospital. She gave you strychnine in small doses. It's a pesticide. It made your seizures come on, which made the doctors flock around you, and which put her at the center of a situation. She has a psychological illness. It's called Munchausen syndrome by proxy. Do you know what that is?
Dot shook her head. It had gotten so hot and steamy in this car all of a sudden, like they were in the middle of a rainforest.
It's when a caregiver either makes up or brings on symptoms in a child because they want attention.
Well, and also because they get joy out of deceiving others who seem more powerful than they are, like nurses and doctors. But because they appear so caring, because they can be so manipulative with the hospital staff and the child, sometimes people don't catch on for a long, long time.
She touched Dot's arm. It's child abuse. The doctors figured it out. That's why they sequestered you to the ICU. You got better there because she wasn't able to get in and put anything in your IV. We had to file a restraining order for her. There was going to be a big investigation. She was going to jail. That's why she left town.
Dot felt vomit rise in her throat.
No. She didn't do any of that. Where's the proof?
Your blood tested positive for strychnine poisoning. I have the paperwork if you want to see it. Once the doctor suspected, they banished you to the ICU. There was a warrant out for Dorothy's arrest.
She didn't poison me. It had to be one of the nurses.
It wasn't.
But she took care of me. She loves me.
No, she didn't. She did the opposite. She tricked you. She tricked all of us.
Her mother's voice shook.
Dot couldn't listen to this anymore. Groaning, she shifted back onto her seat, undid the lock button, and pulled at the door handle.
No!
Her mother cried, reaching for her once more. But instead of grabbing her shoulder, she grabbed the ends of Dot's hair. Dot moved one way. Her mother pulled the other, and there was a horrible ripping sound. White pain shot through Dot's skull, straight to her eyeballs. She screamed out and clutched her head. When she looked over, her mother was trembling. A few strands of hair were in her hands.
I'm sorry,
her mother whispered.
Oh my God, Dot. I didn't mean to do that.
Dot said nothing. just whimpered and cradled her scalp. Let's just go home, okay? I'll take you home.